it hit me like a rock. And that how can you stand in a pulpit and tell the people who come to follow you nothing about that, about how the world is breaking apart right outside your window?
Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. John Archibald, a Pulitzer-winning newspaper columnist, was born 11 days before Martin Luther King Jr. wrote his famous letter from a Birmingham jail. At the time, Archibald's father was a Methodist minister in Alabama, loved by his congregations and loved by his family. But years later, when Archibald discovered a trove of his dad's old sermons, he realized that his father had been mostly silent on the civil rights movement that was changing the world right in front of him. That revelation led Archibald to write his new book, Shaking the Gates of Hell, which attempts to untangle what Archibald learned about his father with what he still loves about him. That's something that resonated with me, and maybe it will with some of y'all too. By the way, I don't want to give away too much, but this episode of Southbound has a post-credits sequence, just like those Marvel movies. So stick around to the very end, especially if you're a college football fan. Now, here's my conversation with John Archibald. Sorry, so let's talk about your book. I want to know first, when you realized you had this treasure trove of your dad's sermons, and then when you realized that there might be a book for you to write about based on them.
See, my dad died in 13, and it was, I got him a year or so after that, I think, and I stuck him in the garage next to, tools and stuff, and didn't think much about them and really forgot that they were there. I didn't know what was inside the file cabinets. They were just sermons, which I didn't think twice about. I mean, I didn't listen to them very much when I was a kid in church either. And so why was I going to listen to them now? But I got to thinking, it was December of 2018. And, I started thinking about, I was thinking about being born, honestly, in April of 1963 at Birmingham, Alabama, at the very moment in time when Dr. King was in jail writing the letter from Birmingham jail, which excoriated the white church, for silence. And I was kind of lamenting the fact that I hadn't ever really talked to my dad about that. So, he had a church and at the time, and I just assumed that, King wasn't talking to him. He was a good guy. And so it dawned on me that there might be something down there. And I went and I looked in this file cabinets, and they were organized in file folders by year, by place, and by date. And I opened them up and I looked, to the date of the Children's Crusade in Birmingham when Dr. King came and was jailed. And it was a huge deal in Birmingham, and of course, and thousands of kids were getting put in jail. And the first thing I opened up to was a sermon during that time period, right then in that moment, that it was for Children's Sunday. That was the name on the church calendar, Children's Sunday. The week after, 1,000 kids were arrested in Birmingham. And I just read it, and it had, references to trouble in faraway places, faraway countries, faraway continents, and talked about the troubles of the world. And it didn't mention Birmingham, and it didn't mention, Montgomery or Selma or any of those things. And it just struck me, it hit me like a rock, in that how can you stand in a pulpit and tell the people who come to follow you nothing about how the world is breaking apart right outside your window. And the more I looked, the Selma to Montgomery march, or the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing, or there was a little reference there, but it was given a very, very small reference to to racism, to bias, I think was the word he used. But it would have been given exactly at the same moment in his church as the bomb went off at 16th Street Baptist Church in an ironically titled sermon my dad was giving called Too Late. And it was too late.
Before all this, before you started digging into your dad's work and thinking about it in an in-depth way, how would you have described him?
Well, I would describe him honestly the same way I would describe him now. And that is he's the best man I've ever known. And I considered him to be the most courageous person I've ever known, the absolute most principled person I've ever known. He taught me everything I believe about equality and about treating other people as you would want to be treated. I mean, everything that makes me what I am, you know, came from him. But it also, you know, was very disappointing because when you look at the people you admire the most and you see their flaws, it hurts. It's disappointing. You know, King in that letter said, I keep quoting that letter, where there's great disappointment, there has to be great love. And I think that that's exactly the feeling I feel here. Both, and it really became a theme for the book because it's about, that's true of my dad, but it's also about, you know, the church. It's also about people. It's also about the institutions that I think are supposed to be better than that.
You point out several places where your dad sort of takes a nostalgic tone, where I think the way you put it in the book is at moments when he should be looking outward and forward, he's looking inward and backward. But that seems to be kind of a hallmark of a lot of people back then. I know you went back and talked to other people who were around and active during then, and there sure weren't a whole lot of other people speaking out either, especially in the white clergy, right? Your dad was not an outlier in that sense.
No, he was not. Not in any way, which is really the point, because it tries to, because what the search really became, why was this man who believed better and thought better and practiced better at home, why could he be silent? And so it was a search for this conspiracy of silence, as a college professor that I talked about. And it was clear from talking to preachers who did preach about integrating the churches in that time, or about desegregation period. Many of them were relegated to very small churches for their careers. And if you don't know about the Methodist Church, the way it's set up is, you know, you're supposed to move every few years, you know, to keep things fresh. And to, you basically, if you don't make a lot of waves and you do what you're supposed to do, you move up to a bigger church with a bigger salary and nicer house and blah, blah, blah. And so those who preached of the race question, as they called it, found themselves in small dead end careers. And so everybody I talked to said, you know, he did this for, you know, they would inevitably say he was a quiet ally, whatever. When you got a pulpit, we'll get into that. But they would say he did it for you. He did it for your family. He did it to make give you a better life. And I get that, although it doesn't make me feel better.
I was going to say, I think I heard an interview with you recently where that makes you feel complicit somehow, where because he, if he was doing it for you, then it was, you know, there's some sense that it was your family's fault. And I know, you know, that's not
right,
accurate in a sort of emotional way, but it's, it doesn't mean you don't feel it, right?
Right. And hyperbole is one of the tools in my tool belt. You should know. But it's true. It didn't answer the question. I mean, it did answer the question intellectually. I mean, I knew that, but it didn't, it was really hard I just couldn't find equilibrium there because he, like I said before, was uncompromising in his principles, you know, in just about all of the time. I mean, I came to kind of conclude, I think that, you know, I mean, his father was a Methodist preacher, and his father was a Methodist preacher, and his father-in-law was a Methodist preacher, and his father-in-law's father was a Methodist. And, you know, it's so deep and ingrained. I've got an aunt and uncle who are Methodist preachers. And I think he loved the church as much as he loved anything in life. And when I say the church, I mean Methodism, the structure, everything about it, you know. So I think that he was a company man.
One of the things I got the sense of as I was reading through this book is that I could feel you sort of, I don't know if this is the right word, but searching for a happy ending. Like you were looking for something in your dad's work that's where he turned a corner, or some story from the past that illuminated something that just ended up never being quite there. And in fact, sometimes the good intentions turned out making things worse in some ways. I think of that story you tell about Julius Scott and your dad's friend who got him into this camp, right? Can you tell that story real quick?
Absolutely. This is at Camp Simatonga. It's a Methodist church camp in Alabama, and it's my family was in, you know, had a little role in getting it started up. But my dad was in a position. This was in the 50s. This was early. It's like the 53 or 4. But his friend Nina Reeves was a woman who had just become the youth director there. And she invited a friend of hers, Dr. Julius Scott, who would later go on to be, college president and really a high ranking figure within the National Methodist Church. But at that time, he was a young man. And she wanted to invite him to come to Camp Simatonga for one of the camps and to talk to the kids. And she asked my dad, and my dad said, you know, sure, that's great with me, but we need to, you know, go through the process, right? He was a process guy, you know. So he went through the process and asked this board that overseed it, which happened to feature my grandfather, who sat on the board. They said he could come, but he had to sit at a table by himself with a sign that said nobody else can sit there. He had to sleep in a room by himself. And that was like, and Nina Reeves was like, that's ridiculous. We're just not going to do it. But I talked to both Nina and Julius Scott about this, but Scott said, no, come on, they're going to have me. I'm going to come. And he came, but he brought, there was a white friend minister who said, well, I'm going to stay with him if he does. And so he went and stayed in the room. And he, the first day he did his thing. And, when he came down to lunch, the first day he ate his lunch there, the second day he came down to lunch and he said he couldn't even, you know, see the sign anymore because there were too many of the kids who had come to sit down at it. And so it was covered with all these kids and they wanted to talk to him. And he ate with them and he talked with them and walked with them. And when I talked to him, he said, you know, it was a great success because of Nina Reeves' courage and that, and it was really heartwarming, that part. I was like, well, what's happening here? This is looking good. And and then I talked to Nina again, and she said, well, there's more to the story, and it involved your parents and your father and grandfather. So I said, well, we better hear it. But it turned out that during his stay at Simatonga, Julie Scott had, taken a walk with kids, I said, and he had been spotted walking through the Vesper Trail, which is just right outside the cafeteria, I believe, with a 12-year-old white girl who was the daughter of a preacher or a conference official. And they were talking on the Vesper Trail, which was in 1953 considered a grave sin among white people in Alabama. So news of this apparently traveled very quickly across the conference that this happened, and people were outraged and they were demanding Nina Reeves be fired for this. And that this never happened again. So it went back before that committee that my grandfather was on that had approved it in the first place. And, And my dad stepped up to say, hey, you guys told her. I mean, he defended her in that case. But the board finally came around. She said my grandfather was silent on the issue, though she thought he used some influence to help her keep from getting fired. But they ultimately said, you don't have, you're right, we did tell you you could come. But they also said, we don't need to have more black people come to Camp Sumatonga. And in fact, we don't need to have black people at Camp Sumatonga at all. So they fired all of the black cooks at Camp Sumatonga. And it was stunning to me. I mean, it was 1953 Alabama. I don't know why I'm stunned, but I always thought that this was a better place. And that, I mean, that camp was a place of opportunity where, frankly, they taught me all those songs about, all the children of the world, red and yellow, black and white, and didn't mean a damn word of it.
When we come back, John Archibald talks about trying to reconcile his love for his father with his disappointment in his father's work and how it feels like torture to him.
But the torture comes in, I want to hold him as accountable as he needs to be held accountable for. But I don't, but I also want to tell, the fullness of him and the many ways that he was, like I said, the best person I've ever known.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Hey y'all, I wanted to let you know about another great Southern podcast you might like. This one from our friends at VPM and Witness Docs. It's called Seizing Freedom. You might have learned that the Emancipation Proclamation and the Union's victory in the Civil War ended slavery in America. But so much more went into abolishing slavery than battles and declarations. And freedom meant more to black people than eventually being paid for their labor. Seizing Freedom focuses on what black people did to define freedom for themselves. You'll hear in their own words how they fought to liberate themselves during the Civil War and how they made freedom real by organizing for equality and justice during Reconstruction, despite every attempt at violent suppression. Seizing Freedom draws from letters, diary entries, autobiographies, and more to showcase voices from American history that have been ignored time and time again. Find the show at seizingfreedom.com and follow it in Stitcher or wherever you listen to podcasts. And now, back to our conversation with John Archibald. In several parts of this book, you sort of address your dad directly, like you're talking to him face to face. And I'm wondering two things about that. One, were you also doing that as you were originally reading these sermons? And two, when he was alive, what sort of stuff did y'all argue about, if anything?
There wasn't a lot of arguing. I mean, frankly, my dad told me things when I was young and I did them. No, that's not true. That is not true at all. My dad told me things. And I said I would do them. And I went out and did whatever I was going to do. And I was the last of the kids. And I got in a lot of trouble. And I was, I always got away with it pretty much, at least at home, because I was pleasant about it, and we got along. So we didn't have to fight because it was my philosophy that what he didn't know didn't hurt it. And or didn't hurt me. And so, and again, throughout my whole life, I had a great respect for him, but I had also that kind of respect that may have prevented me from being able to talk about those things that were truly important to me. And that's why I include a lot of stuff in there about fishing and things like that. Those moments where, if we were fishing or if we were watching Alabama football, we were on the same wavelength the whole time, and that's what those kind of things do for people. But, well, I say that we were on the same wavelength until the Budweiser commercial came on TV, and then, and he, uh, He didn't like that. So that was the moments of tension were between the gang and the time.
He does sound like he did sound like the one of the strictest teetotalers I've ever
he
met.
Was, and it was so bad because I remember having to call him to pick me up stone cold drunk when I was 14 years old, and that didn't go well.
Along the way in this book, as you deal with, as your dad put it, the race question, you also bring in some other things like the, I guess to put it in that framework, the gay question. You have an older brother who's gay, and you talk about how your dad embraced him and loved him and you know, did not look down on him in any way. But you also talk about how the Methodist Church that your dad worked for a long time and still in some ways does not fully support its gay members.
You know, that's, you know, the parallels in these things with in the language of the church and in the way my dad dealt with them are really pretty similar in that, you know, in the 60s, he was always reaching out to other black preachers and people to become involved, integrated a scout troop, demanded that I go to integrated public schools as soon as it was possible to do so in Alabama. The LGBTQ stuff, he never questioned his love for my brother, but at the same time he didn't talk about that he's not gonna put it in a sermon there for years. I mean, he kept that as separate and isolated as he did the race question for a very long time, until you know, as society changes, we change, until he grew into his voice as well. You know, the church itself, I mean, I take the church to task maybe more than I do there to him in that regard. And, you know, I take myself to task too in that regard, because I realized some say I beat myself up too hard about it, but, you know, for a long time, I never talked about my brother being gay. It's like 1985 or something. And my brother was never, I mean, he was out his whole life, essentially. It's not like a surprise to anybody. But it was the 70s when he, you know, officially came out. And that was a different time and place, of course, than it is now. And, you know, so by the 80s, when my sister mentioned something to my soon-to-be wife, who's still my wife, about my brother being gay, she said, "Oh, did John not tell you that?" And my wife, no, she said, "Of course he did," and just, you know, went on, which I was a lie. I had never said it. She covered for me and passed that test at the same time. But that just ate at me as I was doing this. It ate at me because, you know, it's just one of those moments where you find a reason not to say something. And there are plenty of good reasons not to say something sometimes. You can always find a good reason not to say something if you don't say something. And I just felt like it was disloyal. And I felt like it was, it spoke more about me than it did anything else. And so I included that.
But I wonder if you also at that moment felt maybe the way that your dad would have felt thinking about race in the 60s. Like looking back, it's hard to justify it. But in the moment, you found the reasons, right?
Absolutely.
And so did that sort of resonate with you as to maybe how your dad was dealing with it?
Right. And that's why I wanted to put it in there, because there are always those issues. And so I want to be real clear about it I say this too much, probably I should find different ways to say things, but it really is. I mean, I understand completely that I cannot take myself and put myself back in 1953 or 1963 or 1973 and say, you know, I would do this in this situation. It's impossible. It can't be done. We can't with any degree of surety know what we would do. I don't want this perceived as, look how bad my dad was in this time. I want to say, oh my God, this man, even this conspiracy of silence, this pressure, this peer pressure, this way of thinking affected the man I respect most in his life then. What does that mean for me now? I mean, and how do I look at what I wish he'd done then and find the strength to do it now.
You became, obviously, a newspaper columnist, somebody who takes very strong stands in a place where those stands are in the minority most of the time in Alabama. And I know that you did not consciously understand, you know, your dad's sort of silence on the issues of the day until you've been doing this for a long time. But I do wonder if subconsciously or not, you have sort of tried to set out to maybe do things differently, to kind of right your father's wrongs. I hope that's not a bad way of saying it. I mean, have you thought about that at all?
I have. I have a lot. I mean, I've been tortured by this from the start, to be honest with you. I've been excited because I think it is a good vehicle to tell, you know, the story of the dangers of silence. But but the torture comes in, you know, I want to hold him as accountable as he needs to be held accountable for. But I also want to tell, you know, the fullness of him and the many ways that he was, you know, like I said, the best person I've ever known. That's been really difficult, but it has made me examine everything about it. And there's a point in there where, you know, he's near his death and I'd written some story on a big story. And he was in hospice and he reached out and grabbed my hand. It's the last thing he really said to me in life and said, I'm proud of you for, you know, taking on the race question, which is, again, a phrase that they all often used in that time period, which I have some issues with, but I knew exactly what he meant. And it seemed to me, I mean, I've told myself throughout this that he would be euphoric at the point I'm trying to make. And he might not like airing his dirty laundry, as it were, but I feel like he would be really comfortable with the people who get what I'm trying to say.
I know this book, as we talk, has just come out, but have you heard much back from family members and maybe some of your dad's former parishioners, that sort of thing? What's the feedback been like?
I mean, I'm afraid to say it out loud because that'll doom it. So far it's been remarkable. And I let my brothers and sisters read it before I submitted it because our family is very close still. And I don't want to ruin that. And you know, I have, you know, two brothers and a sister and two of them really liked it. And one really just didn't like the style of it. He didn't complain about, I mean, he understood the purpose and you know, some issues there. But, you know, I was worried about cousins and things like that because we share grandparents, of course. But I've heard from them and they've all been really, really supportive and have offered more supporting documentation from decades past to, you know, give me even more insight and really more kind of assurance that I was making the right calls.
A lot of this book, as you said, is sort of your struggle and understanding not just your dad and that time, but the Methodist Church, you know, past and present. Are you still a churchgoer?
I don't go as often as my dad would like. when the church, you mentioned earlier that the Methodist Church is involved in a sort of schism over the issue of gay marriage, and the church has used a lot of language in very similar terms to that of the civil rights discussion about about cutting off funding and lobbying and using the same language. There was a point where I said, I'm not going back, and I wrote it. Because that's, you know, if I think it, I write it, essentially. and it was a bold statement. that I've had some second thoughts about, because more than anything, I don't consider myself that religious.
Yeah, I guess the question I kind of wanted to get at was, are you still a believer?
I believe in a lot of things. I believe in the things that Jesus said. I have some questions about the more supernatural elements of religion. I don't know that, I think a lot of people would think that blasphemy and say that I'm not a Christian at all. I would disagree. But everything I am and everything I will ever be is tied up in the teachings of that church, but not in a way that's not typical of most people. I mean, I the Beatitudes, the Sermon on the Mount, the words of Jesus himself, who essentially told us to care for other people. That seems to be the ironic part of this religion that's named after him, is that that's not usually the way it's practiced.
I wanted to ask you about one Alabama thing. In the book, you quote a friend of yours as talking about the Alabamification of America and how that may expand to be like the whole earth, basically. And it's based on this idea that I never really thought of before, but I think sums it up really well, is that it's when people start to care about having a common enemy more than looking out for the common good. One thing that explains Alabama Auburn better than anything I've ever heard before. But secondly, you've lived in Alabama most of your life, pretty much all your life, and you've dealt with that and written about it pretty much all your life. The rest of the country and the rest of the world is starting to experience that in a more profound way. And so I guess what I wanted to ask you is, having lived it from the inside, do you have sort of survival tips for everybody else?
It's interesting. The guy who said that was Kyle Whitmire, who's also a columnist at Alabama Media Group with me. And I wish I had coined that phrase desperately, because I would have, although if I had coined that phrase, I would have pitched it as a book that would have been different than this one. And it would have been harder. But I think that the key first of all, we call it the Alabamification of America, but we know, living in the South, that the South has always been dealing with a lot of the issues we talk about, and the rest of the country had gotten a pass, really, for not having to deal with it, when in fact they didn't deal with it, and they did just as badly as the South in a lot of cases. We just didn't always know about it, and it wasn't manifested in so as explosive ways. And so they're not perfect up here. But dealing with those things, I think always for me boils down to going out and talking to people like people, and to, to remember that it's hard. I mean, it gets harder and harder every day that passes, because everybody seems to identify with their politics more than they identify. Well, in the South, of course, it's their politics, their football team, and whether they have, and barbecue sauce, I guess those are the things. But somehow or other, that when we disagree over football or barbecue sauce, we can still find a way to sit down at a table and talk to people in ways that we can see them as human, and we can see the fullness of them, and then we can talk to them about issues that are important. And when we can talk to each other about issues that are important, then we can find solutions. With politics these days, it's a lot more difficult, because it's just simmers so deeply, more deeply than I've ever seen it in my life. But I still believe that the only way to deal with it is to see people as people, and to work as hard as you can to make other people see you as a person too.
I want to finish with one thing, and this is, I guess, sort of a weird question, but I think about it personally. My dad died a long time ago. I was 26. And since then, I have dreams that he's in. I daydream about him, think about him all the time. And some of those are in different ways than when he was alive, and I'd see him differently and forgive some things and don't forgive others in the same way you talked about with your dad. I guess the question I'm getting to is, since your dad has passed, and maybe even since you've written this book, if he shows up in your dreams or if you daydream about him, does he look and feel different to you in any way?
No. You know, and I'm, you know, that story, that makes me really sad, though, what you said, because, you know, I think about that. My dad was 83. He'd had cancer, Parkinson's, several kinds of cancer. He was a shell of himself, and he couldn't speak or talk for a long time. So when it was time for him to go, it was time. And I realized, you know, just what a blessing that was for me, because you could grieve along with him and you could feel relief when he was gone. And he would always, when I went in, he would say, you know, he always said, you know, heaven's my home, but I ain't homesick. But by the time he was gone, he was, you know, maybe a little homesick. So when I see my dad in my dreams, he's the way I remember him long before that. And when I remember him, he's smiling, bouncing up and down on his tiptoes, and from the behind the pulpit, you know, and on, you know, I see him there and on those and fishing with him. But I don't feel any, you know, I thought that I would feel some sense of disapproval or something like that. I really feared that it would change how I felt, my father felt about me, rather than how I felt about my father. But I don't think that's the case.
I think of this more as a Catholic teaching than anything else, but it's understood across all faiths that there's such a thing as sins of omission. It's the passive sin, the sin of failing to step up or speak out to keep a bad thing from happening. The white South has sinned and continues to sin by refusing to love its brothers and sisters from other races. But the larger sin in modern times has been so many white Southerners' failure to speak out against those injustices. It's the sin of going along to get along. And what it does is turn over the steering wheel to the worst of us. John Archibald realized that his father, the man he loved and respected the most, committed those sins of omission from the pulpit. It doesn't lessen his love for his dad. It just makes him wish his dad had not gone along with the crowd. The thing I always think about is what I would have done in that same position back in the days when the world was changing so fast. I'd like to think I would have stood up and spoken out. But a part of me worries that I'd have been committing sins of omission too. And it makes me wonder about what things more of us should be preaching about from our own little pulpits right now. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening. Hey y'all, for those of you who stuck around to the end, here's a little bonus for you. Among other things, John Archibald is a diehard Alabama football fan. And here's a little riff from him about his Crimson Tide superstitions.
You know, it's embarrassing to tell you about my superstitions. I don't consider myself superstitious. I'm more like sortastitious, as it is, but except on this matter, in which I have for the last 5 years anyway, maybe more, had to eat seafood on every Alabama game day. And if I don't, then I have people calling up. I mean, you know, it has to happen. I have to eat the fish. And my wife doesn't like fish, so she She's not happy about that. But I love fish, so it works both ways for me.
Does it have to be like a certain kind or from a certain place?
Well, it started out being real expensive, but then, you know, it was really, we figured the more, you know, it cost, the more it would help. But then when Clemson beat Alabama so bad in the championship game the other day, I had this massive seafood feast, this soup that had, you know, $150 worth of fish in it or whatever. And we got killed. So I scaled back, and now it's become that I have to eat the cheapest canned tuna that I can. And it's so bad that that Alabama basketball is finally doing sort of well now. So now I'm having to do it during basketball season too. And I'm going to die of mercury poisoning because of my sort of stition, I guess.